WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Foster was perhaps the first full-time professional pop songwriter. He made a living from sheet music sales. This was back in the infancy of pop music in the 19th century, before the days of records and radio. Foster's role as one of the fathers of pop music is one reason why rock critic Ken Emerson has written a new biography of Stephen Foster. Many of Foster's songs are still in the air, like "O Susanna," "Genie with the Light Brown Hair," "My Old Kentucky Home," "Camptown Races," and "Beautiful Dreamer." As we'll hear, Emerson was also fascinated by the complicated racial meaning of Foster's songs. Some of his songs are written in black dialect for blackface minstrels and are now considered embarrassments, like "Masses in De Cold Ground" and "Old Black Joe." Ken Emerson wants us to hear a recording of Foster's song "Old Folks at Home," performed by Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers. Here's why.
It's particularly interesting because obviously Louis Armstrong did not want to sing this song. And as you hear it after a brilliant trumpet solo, you'll hear increasingly caustic comments in his inimitable voice. And it shows some of the ways in which Stephen Foster's music to this day is a source of racial embarrassment and infuriation. At the same time, the Mills Brothers are singing this in a very straightforward way. They have no problems with the material, and indeed it's very sentimental and nostalgic. And they do not trip over the word darky, which obviously is no longer a word that any of us would care to use. It doesn't have given them any offense. The double nature of this song shows the sort of divided legacy of Stephen Foster, who, after all, wrote the most famous songs of the 19th century written by an American that still in many ways define American culture. And we have this dual, double-divided feeling about the music that is exemplified in this recording.
Well, let's hear it. Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers.
On the Swanee River, far, far away, far away. There's where my heart is turning ever, there's where the old folks stay. All up and down the old creation, sadly I roam. Still longing for the old plantation and for the old folks at home. All the world am sad and weary everywhere I roam. Oh, dark is how my heart grows weary, far from the old folks at home.
Now, brothers, it was way down upon the Swanee River.
Far, far away.
There's where my heart is turning pepper.
There's where the old folks stay.
Yowzer, all up and down the whole creation.
Sadly he roams.
You know one thing, my heart am still longing for the old plantation.
And for the old folks at home.
Now sing, brothers.
All the world
hallelujah, hallelujah.
Everywhere I roam.
Yeah, man. Oh, dark is how my heart grows weary.
Far from the old.
Well, look over here. We are far away from home. Yeah, man.
Louis Armstrong and the Mills Brothers singing one of Stephen Foster's most famous songs. My guest Ken Emerson has written a new biography of Foster called Doodah. Well, Stephen Foster certainly had a very complicated relationship to African Americans and African American music. And, I mean, on the surface, boy, what a really hateful song the lyrics are. You know, sung from the point of view of an African American yearning to be back on that old plantation. On the other hand, as you point out in your book, Stephen Foster really drew a lot from black music and was inspired by black music. So at one time, his music both condescends to and is inspired by African Americans.
Sounds like rock and roll today, doesn't it?
It was rock and roll, you say, that connected you to Stephen Foster.
Well,
hard as that may be to believe.
Well, I began my checkered career as a rock critic, and I was always fascinated from the very beginning. When did the impulse among white teenagers to imitate blacks first begin? Obviously, from Elvis Presley to Beck, that has been an important part of rock and roll, but clearly it didn't begin with Elvis Presley. And I sort of pressed it back and thought and listened and learned more and more about the swing era and the Benny Goodmans and the other nice boys from the Jewish projects of Chicago who fell in love with swing. And going back to the turn of the century and songwriters such as George Gershwin and Irving Berlin, who were deeply influenced by African-American music and emulated it, not only in operas like Porgy and Bess, but in Irving Berlin's first hit song, Alexander's Ragtime Band, which caused him to be mislabeled the King of Ragtime, when obviously Scott Joplin deserved that title. But it goes further back to minstrelsy and blackface back in the 1830s and 1840s and to Stephen Foster and this weird form of American popular entertainment, the first original American form of entertainment, and that's the minstrel show.
The whole blackface era is both a disturbing and fascinating part of American pop music history. What explanations have you been able to come up with for why white people performed in blackface and why that became so popular in the 1800s?
Well, among other things, African Americans represented, in a cruel paradox to many whites and still do, a certain kind of freedom, freedom from bourgeois expectations, freedom from the regimentation of conventional middle-class life. But what many whites don't realize, and indeed sometimes African-Americans don't realize, is that that alleged freedom is the result of oppression and exclusion. So that we always have this, or I shouldn't say we, but at the root of both the rock and roll experience and of the minstrel experience, which was its predecessor, is this tangled, conflicted feeling of the expressing both an oppression and an affection and an admiration simultaneously.
Ken Emerson is my guest, and he's written a new biography of Stephen Foster called Duda. Let's play another one of his famous songs from the Southern tradition he had no part of because he grew up in the Pittsburgh area. This is a song called Old Kentucky Home, one of his really well-known songs. Tell us about how he wrote this song.
Yeah. Well, this is a song that is very controversial to this day. It is the state song of Kentucky, and we're going to play a particularly camp version of it, which is performed nightly during the summer at the outdoor sound and light theater extravaganza that is held in Bardstown, Kentucky at My Old Kentucky Home State Park. And the song, as we listen to it for a while, you'll see sort of epitomizes the sort of the South of cavaliers and crinolines. And yet, ironically, it was actually inspired by Uncle Tom's Cabin, a deeply abolitionist novel. And the sense of loss here, and the sense is because Uncle Tom is being sold down the river, as he was in the famous novel. So we have here again, as in the earlier recording by Louis Armstrong, this sort of dual nature. As a matter of fact, recently, several members of the African American members of the Yale Glee Club were scheduled to perform this song as part of a celebration, a concert celebrating Charles Ives in the context of his music. They refused to sing it. A copy of the song was burned at a meeting by members of the Glee Club, and indeed, another song was substituted. And yet, ironically, here was a song that was inspired by a great abolitionist novel and which no less a leader than Frederick Douglass himself singled out as a song that awakens the sympathies for the slave in which anti-slavery principles take root and flourish. So, like all of Foster's music, it's thick with contradictions that to this day, I think, are part of the American experience.
Well, let's hear the version you've brought of My Old Kentucky Home.
Thank you. The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the children are gay. The corn tops ripe and the meadows in the bloom, while the birds make music all the day. The young folks roll on the little cabin floor, all merry, all happy and bright. While my heart finds someone knocking at my door, and my old Kentucky home good night.
Having heard Old Kentucky Home and Old Folks at Home, you wonder, what was Stephen Foster's attitude about slavery? He wrote these songs while there still was slavery in the United States.
He certainly did. He was, by inclination and by family, he was a Democrat. He was he was actually related by marriage to James Buchanan, who was the president before Abraham Lincoln, who was trying to hold together the Union at any cost and would make any deal necessary to keep the South in. So he... Foster was, by inclination, what you would, was then called a doughface Democrat. He did not. He was certainly not an abolitionist, but he had. And this again is not unlike the contradictions that many Americans feel. On the one hand, his politics were definitely not abolitionist, but his heart and his feelings were very strongly sympathetic with the African American plight. This contradiction, I think, is the conflict between sentimentality and self-interest is something that I think has always characterized Americans.
My guest is Ken Emerson, and he's a music critic who's written a new book called Doodah, Stephen Foster and the Rise of American Popular Culture. Ken, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ken Emerson. His new book, Doodah, is a biography of Stephen Foster. You've brought a version with you of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. Who did you bring singing it, and what do you think of this recording?
Yeah, I think this is a very an excellent recording. It's by the operatic baritone Thomas Hampson, who has come out a couple of years ago with a CD of Foster songs and has become a good friend and co-conspirator of mine. I think what may interest people with this is that it was originally I Dream of Jenny with the Light Brown Hair. Jenny was the nickname of Stephen Foster's wife, to whom he had an unhappy on again marriage, and he wrote this when they were estranged it's a little bit unclear, or possibly just gotten back together again. And he wrote it when he was living in Hoboken, New Jersey, where he set up for about a year. And when you look at the manuscript, there's something very strange about it, and that is that the I's and the J's in the manuscript are these sharp, dagger-like downstrokes, which show, instead of any kind of love for this Jenny, an extreme amount of hostility and anger. And you can tell that this is a relationship where if you're dreaming of Jenny, you may be wishing that she were dead. Anyway, I don't think that Thomas would entirely agree with my interpretation, but I admire his version of the song.
You sure that wasn't just his handwriting?
No, because actually, one has the opportunity to examine all his manuscripts in an archive in Pittsburgh now called the Center for American Music, this is almost unique among his manuscripts in that sense.
Okay, well, let's hear Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair.
I dream of Jeannie with a light brown hair, born like a vapor. summer air. I see her tripping where the bright streams play, happy as the daisies that dance on her way. Many were the wild notes her merry voice would pour, many were the blithe birds that warbled them more. I dream of Jeannie with her light brown hair, floating like a vapor on the soft summer.
Ken Emerson, you know, I think that song is an example of a song that I think people of my generation were born knowing. You didn't necessarily like the song, but you knew the song. I don't know how you knew it, whether it's because your parents sang it or it was just in the air, but you knew it, even though it was not of your time. Why do you think songs like Jeannie have endured the way they have?
I think that Stephen Foster really did create popular music as we still recognize it today. And he did it because he took together all these strands of the American experience. That song is extremely Irish in its origins, just as other songs are extremely African American, just as others are extremely Italian and operatic, sometimes German, and even Czechoslovakian. For instance, the beat of O Susanna is the beat of a polka. And he consciously, it's hard to talk about the degree of consciousness, but he clearly effectively merged them into a single music. And I think he merged them in a way that appeals to the multicultural, mongrel experience of America in its history and culture. And so these songs became embedded in our consciousness, so deeply embedded that, just as you said, that you didn't know where you heard them, and I'm sure you didn't even know who wrote them, Foster's songs became so absorbed into the American experience that it was assumed by many that they were folk songs.
Right.
There was no Stephen Foster. That he just sort of disappeared like Zelig in the Woody Allen film into the far fringes of the frame of our consciousness, even as his songs are, I think, in everybody's memory. And this is still happening. I've been working the last couple of months. I've given some talks and worked several times with high school students in Edward R. Murrow High School in Brooklyn, a very multicultural school where there were many Pakistanis, Hispanics, Soviet Jews. And here, even when you're talking about immigrants and people who came to America within the last couple of years, you say, have you ever heard of Stephen Foster? No, it says no. But all you have to do is hum or sing a few bars of I Dream of Jeannie or Beautiful Dreamer or the Camptown Races, and people light up. They recognize it. It's something, it's like a passport to America.
When I was taking piano lessons when I was young, a lot of the sheet music books would have Stephen Foster songs in it. I think there were two reasons for that. One is because of his enduring popularity, but I think the other was because they're in the public domain. You don't have to pay copyrights to put them in the songbooks.
Exactly, and as a matter of fact, some of his songs only became hits in the 1930s when there was briefly a radio strike against the ASCAP, which at that point was the only licensing a company for music. And so radio stations were scrambling for anything in public domain in order to play on the radio. But there's also a third reason why Foster's music was there. They're easy to play.
Right, right.
And Foster's music was deliberately written in a way that a beginning or certainly intermediate pianists could play it with no difficulty.
My guest is rock critic Ken Emerson. His new book is called Doodah, Stephen Foster and the Rise of American Popular Culture. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with rock critic Ken Emerson, author of Doodah, Stephen Foster and the Rise of American Popular Culture. I know when I told a few people here that we were going to be talking to you about your Stephen Foster biography, I got a couple of real eye rolls like, Stephen Foster, what are they kidding? I can imagine the reaction you got from friends in the rock world when you told them your book was going to be about Stephen Foster.
Yeah, they thought I was taking leave of my senses. you know, it's hardly, I mean, but on the other hand, I think that we all have an interest. And I think that, I know that, I mean, Greil Marcus talked to me about this a little bit when I undertook this. And that, I mean, the ways that Greil and other serious students of rock and roll, Bob Christgau would be another example, all of us have been very interested in its origins and its roots.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way that we were taught that rock and roll didn't exist until the 1950s, when suddenly in the person of Elvis Presley, rock, blues and country music joined together, that just didn't work. The racial mixture and complexity of our music just goes back far longer, and that's to me the more interesting aspect of this. And I know that they, in terms of talking to my friends who are rock critics, past and present, it's something that it interests almost all of them too. This trying to find more of a history to our popular music. After all, at first, perhaps when we were all 13 or 16 years old, we were thrilled by the newness of rock and roll. Maybe as we're getting older, we want to understand its oldness as well.
Your book raises so many interesting issues about pop music and its early history in the United States. But I'm wondering if, in writing the Stephen Foster book, if you also got a new appreciation of his melodies.
Oh, unquestionably. I mean, one of the things you realize is that when you listen to, or you can't listen because it's not available in recording, but when you play or you look at the sheet music of the thousands of other songwriters, as minstrel music became more popular, and as people tried to emulate Stephen Foster's own success, the country was awash with sheet music, and yet only Foster's songs survived. The idea that anybody could write a dozen songs that still exist today in our minds is amazing. And I also came to really respect his craft, which I finally learned was much more sophisticated than I had originally imagined. There's one song he wrote, for instance, which deliberately quotes two measures of Schubert and then quotes two measures of a Robert Burns Scottish ballad, so that you have sort of a Scottish lay and a German lied, you know, spliced. And that kind of wit and craft is something that people didn't realize Foster possessed when we used to think of him as sort of this naive folk poet with his finger on the pulse of the American soul in a sort of a salt-of-the-earth way. He was a much more conscious writer who didn't just compose his songs. He contrived them.
You've brought with you a record that I think will successfully bring together your interest in rock music and your interest in Stephen Foster. Do you want to introduce this for us?
Yes. Well, this is a song that actually was not a great hit during his time, but in the last decade, it's been his most frequently recorded song. One reason I'm sure is because it's neither as saccharine as A Beautiful Dreamer or I Dream of Jeannie. On the other hand, it does not have blackface lyrics that are an embarrassment and an offense to today's ears. That's The Hard Times, Come Again No More, which has been recorded recently by Emmylou Harris, by Bob Dylan. Thomas Hampson is recorded at the McGarrigle Sisters. And I actually think that my favorite version is the least known of them all, and that's by a singer named Sid Straw. And this is a beautiful arrangement by Van Dyke Parks. And this song, I think, became popular in the very late 80s at the when there was a momentary recession at the end of Bush's term, the recession that, even though we'd begun to recover from it, resulted in Bill Clinton's election. And it struck an economic nerve that I think is still touchy in our insecure society today, where even if the stock market is booming, we're all being downsized. So this is Hard Times Come Again No More by Sid Straw.
And before we hear it, let me say to you, Ken, thank you very much for talking with us about your biography of Stephen Foster. And that biography is called Doodah, the author Ken Emerson. Here's its
Thank you very much.